what we were talking about, it wouldn't be called Beyond. And Michael would have talked about it already. so actually, I mean, today's lecture in particular will be a sort of a huge change of pace and of tone from what you heard Michael discuss just before. It's going to be mainly a sort of discussion of perspective of how we do physics beyond the standard model, how you think about it. A lot more talking about doing physics rather than actually talking about physics, which always makes me a little uncomfortable when I do it for an hour straight. So apologies in advance for that, but I couldn't figure out a good way to split it among the five lectures. And it's also really important when you're doing something inherently speculative, like physics beyond the standard model, it is important to think really critically about what you're doing, why you're doing it, what kinds of things you hope to learn from it. And because a lot of it really is risky, you know, force yourself to think about problems where the potential of what you can learn from them really balances out that risk. So I'm going to talk a little bit about at least how I see that, a couple of different ways of thinking about it. And I'm sure at least parts of this will be very familiar to every one of you, but hopefully different parts will be new or different from your usual way of thinking for each of you. And then tomorrow, or perhaps today if I talk really fast, we'll get to more of the meat of it. So tomorrow, there's sort of two different themes for tomorrow and for Friday. Tomorrow, sort of talk about outside the standard model, how to look for physics that doesn't interact with standard model interactions, might have other kinds of interactions though, and present first sort of general framework for thinking about that, and then some specific examples involving dark matter. And on Friday, beyond in the other sense, sort of going above the standard model to higher energies, so talk about LHC phenomenology, beyond the standard model, again, introduction to how to think about the phenomenology of BSM searches and the status of supersymmetry at the LHC in particular, or something like that. Haven't quite decided exactly what I'll cover on Friday. But that's the rough plan, and if anybody really wants me to talk about something different, let me know. There's still time for me to change what I do. So, all right. So where do we start from in going beyond the standard model? Obviously, we start from the standard model. And I think it's worth taking a step back to ask, what is the standard model? I mean, and the first thing to acknowledge is that there is a theory and there is a framework within that which that theory lives. And historically, in the development of the standard model, they really came together side by side. So the framework is a quantum theory of relativistic particles. And it turns out, if you think about that long and hard, that really implies you also are dealing with a local quantum field theory. Within the constraints of that framework, you can then ask, well, what kinds of particles can you have? And I find it pretty surprising that First of all, that this framework imposes severe constraints on the interactions of high-spin particles, and that every possibility allowed by those constraints is actually used by the standard model. So in particular, the highest spin you can have is spin 2, and GR-like theory is sort of the most general thing you can have. And then for spin 1 particles, there could be either abelian or non-abelian structures. Standard model uses both of them. And then there was this very surprising fact that was found about the matter in the standard model that's now central to how we understand it, that actually it's a chiral theory where the left and right-handed fermions have different gauge interactions. And so all of these things are sort of bedrock principles of the standard model. They affect how we understand what we see. They basically mean that once you specify what gauge groups you're talking about, what matter content you're talking about, you can write down a finite list of interactions up to a given mass dimension that are just allowed by symmetry. And in the standard model, with one important exception, it looks like we've probably seen all of those allowed interactions up to dimension 5. Okay, so in that sense, it's a very generic theory, but on the other hand, the structure of many of those parameters is very non-generic. In fact, even going back to the principles we started with, There's many aspects that feel generic, sort of most general thing that you could possibly have, and many others that seem quite peculiar and call for a deeper understanding. So the standard model has been tested extensively in many ways with pretty good precision. For example, even in the case of the Higgs boson, which is a very young part of the standard model, already tested with pretty good precision. So what do you do with such a theory? How do you move beyond it? I think there's sort of three different ways that we can think about that process, and each one points you in a slightly different direction. So I want to talk a little bit about those three ways of approaching it in turn. The first is to just look around us, look for evidence and data that's already been taken, things that have already been seen in the world, that the standard model doesn't describe. Things that tell us that the standard model is clearly not the full theory of nature. Okay, so there's some such things. That's the first direction to pursue. We know the standard model is incomplete. We can also try to understand those things about the theory that look special, look peculiar. Weird parameter structures and flavor, small dimensionful numbers, things like that. So that's something that really starts from theory and then of course moves on because you have to test those theoretical ideas. And the third thing is to just look for ways of pushing, of challenging the theory. Look for opportunities to test whether it's breaking down someplace where you haven't looked yet, so you don't know whether it works or not. And that fundamentally is the spirit of experiment, often guided in part by these first two, but to be truly effective, not entirely guided by them. So, okay, start with the first one. What's the standard model missing? So, to my mind, there are 2.5 things that the standard model is missing completely. Actually, you know, most people, and by the way, there's a sense in which I agree with them, most people will point to this pie chart and say, the biggest evidence that we don't understand what's going on in nature is that we don't understand this dark energy and it makes up 70% of the universe. Now, while I'm sympathetic to that, and I'll come back to it later, there is a sense, a very strict sense, in which actually the dark energy is the one part of this pie chart that we can accommodate within our theory. We can't explain it, but we can fit this with a parameter of the standard model, just cosmological constant. Whereas understanding these other pieces requires something new, period. Like even having a chance of explaining them. So baryon asymmetry. We've got galaxies made of matter, not of antimatter. Right? And basically what this requires is that primordially, you require a 1 part in 10 to the 9 excess of baryons over antibaryons in the early universe. Do we have a pointer or a hockey stick, by the way? Ah, yes. Excellent.
I'm wondering what you're looking for.
Fortunately, I put all the stuff I want to point to low on the slide, so I didn't really need it. And then it annihilates away, and you'd end up with a larger asymmetry of baryons over, complete asymmetry of baryons over antibaryons, with the abundance of baryons that we see today. So then the question is, where would this small asymmetry come from? And, well, it wasn't obvious at all, and it still isn't obvious qualitatively, that this can't come within the standard model. So where would this asymmetry come from? Well, Sakharov identified 3 conditions that you need to get an asymmetry. Clearly, if you're going to have more baryons than antibaryons, you need some baryon number violation. But you also need to be able to actually have a difference between baryon production and baryon depletion. That requires C and CP violation. And finally, you need to be outside of thermal equilibrium. Otherwise, detailed balance would tell you that everything ends up with its equilibrium abundance anyway. Now, we know the standard model violates C and CP. That's fine. Baryon number, standard model doesn't violate, doesn't break baryon number perturbatively, but it's an anomalous symmetry of the standard model. So non-perturbative effects in the standard model do violate baryon number. And in fact, those become important precisely around the time of the weak phase transition. And phase transitions have the potential for a substantial departure from thermal equilibrium. So standard model really has all three of these things. And yet quantitatively, it just fails very badly. So a standard model Higgs sector does not have a first order enough phase transition. Basically, all three of these effects end up being pretty small. Baryon number violation because it's a non-perturbative effect. CP violation is just small when you ask about it in an invariant way. The Jarlskog invariant is small because the CKM angles are small. And that would still be okay if you had a strongly first order phase transition to get way out of thermal equilibrium. But based on the parameters we've measured for the standard model, it's not a strongly first order phase transition. So quantitatively, it just can't explain the baryon asymmetry. Now, you can change that electroweak phase transition by adding new scalars that couple significantly to the Higgs. That's testable. It's getting more and more constrained by LHC data. And the more constrained it gets, the more it pushes us away from this whole scenario of using the electroweak phase transition to explain baryogenesis. In that case, you need even more new physics, something completely new, a new source for the asymmetry, as well as a new source for the thermal non-equilibrium. And, well, this possibility, pretty firmly within that there's new physics that just fixes the standard model almost works, you just need to fix up the last Sakharov condition. That's getting tested now. It's accessible, which is saying it's very accessible, otherwise we wouldn't be able to test it. But this possibility, we don't know. That could be very high energy physics. It could be moderate or low energy physics. But it's potentially very exciting because if it is at experimentally accessible energies, then you might be able to actually get a handle on all three conditions experimentally. And even if it's not at a directly accessible energy, you might still be able to learn something about it from other precision measurements. So this is one thing that we know the standard model is definitely missing and that explains a very basic feature of our world. The second one, actually the largest unexplained piece of the pie chart, is dark matter itself. From galaxy rotation curves, we wouldn't know whether the dark matter is made of baryons, clumps of baryons, or not. But from early universe measurements, like the CMB, we really know that it's non-baryonic and that it's not tightly coupled to photons and electrons. So the most conservative explanation for that is one or more new particles. There you go. That's definitely beyond the standard model. The alternatives that you can come up with are also beyond the standard model. In the sense that, for example, if you want to say, oh, there's no need to invoke new kinds of particles, just primordial mini black holes, well, you need some particular dynamics in order to produce those black holes cosmologically. That's beyond the standard model. Modified gravity is certainly involving new particles and new interactions at very long distance scales, so very low masses. So again, definitely beyond the standard model, and also very difficult to really make that work in a compelling way. So I'll stick to the case of dark matter. Of course, again, like baryogenesis, dark matter doesn't intrinsically and firmly predict a scale. But general scenarios for dark matter do. So I know Mariangela already talked some about WIMPs. I unfortunately missed her lecture, so I don't know how much the little I'm going to say will overlap with what she said. But the basic story that I'm sure most of you have seen in her lectures and elsewhere is that dark matter could interact with the standard model in order to stay in thermal equilibrium for a while, until the interaction, the depletion of the dark matter, means that actually they interact much less frequently than the characteristic expansion time set by the inverse Hubble scale. And at that point, whatever dark matter you have left stays and just expands, just dilutes away with the expanding universe, but ceases to annihilate down, even though the thermal density would keep falling exponentially. And that transition point determines the dark matter abundance today. Well, you know how the annihilation cross-section scales. It's going to scale like some coupling squared over, or coupling to the fourth typically, over a mass, times some mass squared scale, some overall characteristic mass scale for the dark matter. And that tells you, well, this number could be small or this number could be small, but certainly the coupling is bounded by 4 pi. And so you want to make sure, and the coupling goes in the denominator, so this prefactor can only go so small, which means that to get consistent with the observed dark matter density, the mass can only go so big. Okay, so even with strong coupling, you would get, for this scenario, where dark matter ever came into thermal equilibrium with ordinary matter in the early universe, a maximum mass where you can produce, where you can get the right abundance. And then lower masses, weaker couplings are okay, but higher masses, stronger couplings cease to make sense because we're already talking about a strongly coupled theory. And that cutoff mass is of the order of 10 to 100 TeV. It's hard to turn that into a firm exact number because it's based on a unitarity bound rather than something extremely precise. But this is an accessible mass scale. So I think that's a very exciting hint that there could be opportunities to probe all of this parameter space from the high energy strong couplings on down. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is neutrino masses. Now, there's a sense in which maybe this isn't a failure. You can just add, of the standard model, you can just add a new operator, a Majorana mass operator, which is dimension 5. But in that case, because it's a dimension 5 operator, it's going to become strong at some characteristic scale. There should be new physics associated with that scale. And the scale of that new physics should be less than about 10 to the 15 GeV, given the bounds we have on the neutrino masses. So that really implies that there should be a new physical scale in the theory, new degrees of freedom at that scale. But of course, if it's up at 10 to the 15 GeV, out of reach for direct experiments, possible connections to generation of the baryon asymmetry through a lepton asymmetry, possible connections to, obviously, things you can learn about it by studying the low-energy physics of neutrinos. Although you can't ever really resolve from low-energy measurements what physical scale this is coming from or what the magnitude, absolute magnitude of the couplings are, because those two are degenerate. Do you want to say something?
H stands means E.
Sorry, yes. Capital H here means Higgs. L is a lepton doublet. Thank you.
In parameter representation, we use CSOM model. And in CSOM model, we don't represent any Higgs. I mean, the origin of mass in parameter representation is something else.
Well, you can write, so you can UV complete this operator. So in a CSOM model, you have some very heavy right-handed neutrinos, right? If you want to, if, in particular, if you're trying to write down a theory at valid at low energies, like TeV scale, below the mass of that right-handed neutrino, you can integrate it out, and you're left with this kind of interaction. Right? So you're really starting from this kind of operator, where the right-handed neutrino N is very heavy, and then integrating that out, you would get precisely something like this, where C over lambda ends up being something like this little lambda squared with the appropriate index contractions divided by the mass of that right-handed neutrino. What's useful about thinking about it this way is that there's different ways of completing it. It could be a right-handed neutrino. It could be, you could get this from a triplet fermion rather than a singlet fermion, and you'd get the same kind of operators. And so this is a more invariant way to talk about what you'd be measuring, for example, in the combination of neutrino oscillation experiments and double beta decay, neutrinoless double beta decay experiments. Right? Because we're never going to measure whether we really have a triplet or a singlet or a loop of something else going on at high energies. But what we can measure and what we can talk about invariantly at low energies, in this case of Majorana mass, is an operator of this form. Now, of course, I'm sort of taking this slide out of order. This is the case where, at face value within the standard model, you can accommodate the neutrino masses just by adding this extra operator. But if you said that's the theory of the world, just add this operator, that's analogous to something like the Fermi theory for weak interactions. It worked perfectly well at low energies. It was a useful theory. But you know that to keep the theory unitary at high energies, one had to introduce new particles. In the case of the Fermi interactions, that turned out to be the W and the Z. In this case, it could be right-handed neutrinos, triplets, something like that. The other possibility is a Dirac mass, and that is just associated with a light singlet fermion, N. So you just have a Dirac mass for the light, for a light neutrino. The only sort of problem with this is that the coupling would have to be very small. Of course, the coupling for the electron is already quite small. So who knows? I mean, this is an experimental question that we still don't know. We know neutrinos have mass, but we still don't know which form of a mass term they actually have or how to write down a Lagrangian that includes their mass correctly. And which one is actually correct determines how you think about what new physics neutrinos could imply. Is it the sort of light but boring option that you're just adding a new singlet? So no interactions, just a new, but technically a new degree of freedom. Or some pretty interesting new interactions, but at a very high mass scale. So those are the three things I could think of. Actually, I welcome you, if you think I've left something out, to bring it up, that are really things the standard model fails to account for, that cannot be accommodated in the standard model at all, and there just must be something else. What they don't tell us is, A, how accessible that new physics will be. In the case of dark matter, there's a sort of loose argument that it will be accessible. In the others, we really don't know. Whether it's something really simple or something actually very rich and intricate. And whether it's sort of just adding another row to this chart or something that's really enlarging the structure of the standard model and changing the way we think about it in an important way. But each of these problems has the potential to be answered in a way that does teach us a lot, that does have some profound implications. And so we just have to look for it and see what it turns out to be. So is there anything else that people think I should add to this list?
Strong CP problem?
That's on my next list. The reason is, no, it sounds like a cheat answer. The reason is that it's a perfectly valid parameter choice for the standard model to just set the angle to make the strong CP angle to zero. Whereas there's no choice of parameters where you could explain any of these without invoking some new physics, unless you want to split hairs about what I really mean by new physics in the case of neutrino masses, in which case, you know. I'm just adding another spin to the neutrino. That's not a new particle. Or I'm just adding an operator that breaks down at the gut scale. That's not a new particle.
Sorry? You want to blow that?
That's true.
So there's a problem of the same kind before that, right?
Right. I mean, so gravity becomes strongly coupled as well at a lower energy scale than the U1 Landau pole. So it's certainly fair to say that just like neutrino masses require a UV completion, gravity requires a UV completion. And if that UV completion involves going to higher energies in an effective field theory of some kind, then the U1 Landau pole requires a UV completion. And yeah, I think that's a legitimate one to include here, that those are really things that absolutely dead force you to go beyond the standard model.
The time of inflation?
Yeah, I think so.
There's the Shaposhnikov theory of inflation.
Right, although it's adding enough new interactions that I think it counts as beyond as well.
And the relation of couple constants is on your next list.
Right. Okay. Although in a way that might make it look spectacularly unimpressive. Okay. Yeah, so. So I really do think of these as being a different category of motivations with different pros and different strengths and weaknesses relative to the ones I just talked about. There are a lot of peculiar small parameters in the standard model, and small numbers like the precision gauge unification is a few percent level coincidence, depending on how well it works in the model of choice. This is what you were referring to, right? Unification. So so of course the largest ones numerically are a cosmological constant in the hierarchy problem. I'm actually going a lot slower than I anticipated. So I might postpone. I was going to talk in some detail about the hierarchy problem, but I think I'll postpone that to Friday since I'm talking about that kind of physics anyway.
About time?
Should I not be worried about time?
I don't think so.
What's the...
energetic. No, we don't have any really sharp constraints as a fatigue.
All right. Well, I do want to play a game with you guys later on.
Okay.
So I'm going to save all the energy for that, and we can come to the high. The game may fail, by the way. It's the kind of thing I have never, ever tried in a lecture before, but I want to see what happens, because I had fun with it this weekend. Okay. I wasn't going to spend much time talking about these except the hierarchy problem, and now I'm not going to spend much time talking about the hierarchy problem. I should ask, how do you guys feel about the strong CP problem? Like, by which I mean not, you know, I don't mean what do you think the strong CP angle really is in your bones. do you want to talk more about the strong CP problem another day?
No.
All right, who's in favor? More strong CP. Who's in favor of less strong CP? Wow. All right, you seem to be in the minority. But it's a dictatorship, so I don't know what I'll do.
Benevolent dictatorship.
Benevolent, of course. Of course.
What is this? Fermion masses?
So this is, and actually, Michael, you may know this. So this, there are some pretty small Yukawa couplings in the standard model. There are some big Yukawa couplings. There's clearly some structure in there, and we don't understand where it comes from. So 10 to the minus 5 is just the ratio of the biggest to the smallest Yukawa coupling in the standard model, roughly speaking. That's probably actually an understatement of how bizarre flavor is, though. Because there's a lot more structure in there than that. And maybe there's other small numbers that I should multiply in to really quantify how, you know, how upsetting this is.
Between the 10 to the minus 5 and the minus 1, for example, there's the mixing, the part mixing parameter.
Right, of course, that's right. That's part of the flavor problem overall. So maybe I should multiply that in with 10 to the minus 5 and get... I'm not sure how to count it. This is the problem. This is the problem with small numbers, right? Is that well, most of these are just simple ratios. This one's just a lot of small numbers together, and it's not clear whether there's right. Exactly. So perhaps it really is just 1/10 to the minus 2-ish number in a variety of combinations that explains all of it. And that's, you know, that is a real possibility that changes how you think about that. But then again, that would count as an explanation, I think, if you actually had a justification for taking the square root.
Right, but it would be beyond the standard.
Right. Okay, sorry. So, all right, I'll save the hierarchy problem for Friday. But I do want to make one sort of polemical point now about these, because all of these, and in particular the hierarchy problem, I think most people, when they think about what it means to do beyond the standard model physics, at least many people of the sort of academic generation immediately before mine, it's really all about this set of problems. And this set of problems, notice I'm only starting my pointer up here, this set of problems. This set of problems is often used as a yardstick to determine the worth of particular beyond the standard model thinking. And I mean, it's clearly an important yardstick. If you can explain a 10 to the minus 32, or you can explain a 10 to the minus 11, and you can verify that theory, that is a major accomplishment, right? But it's also true that this is not the only yardstick. You know, we just talked about some of the other observational yardsticks, the things we know have to be explained. And that while these are things that keep us up at night, these are things that frustrate us as theorists, having a 10 to the minus 32 that you can't explain, they don't strictly require a solution, right? As upsetting as it is logically possible that that's just the way it is. And why it is that way, we'll never know. But it's just the wrong question to be asking. On the other hand, I don't think that should discourage us from thinking about these problems. And the reason for that, I actually think if they were likely to have really boring solutions that teach us nothing else about the universe, then that would be reason enough to stop thinking about them. Okay? But these are precisely problems whose solutions are likely to be pretty intricate. Okay, it's not like our sterile right-handed neutrino can explain this stuff. You really need new symmetries. an extension of how we think about the standard model and some pretty dramatic stuff in order to explain any of this. In fact, the biggest one on the block, the cosmological constant, there aren't even really any good ideas for it. And so that, despite the uncertainty that they may not have, that it may be just this, sorry man, don't ask me why the sky is blue. There's no answer, it just is. Possibility. They're worth thinking about very hard because there might be a reason, and if there is, it's probably a pretty interesting one. Okay, so that was the polemicism there. I'm almost onto the game. Good. So the last chunk I wanted to talk about, and actually this is going to be mostly historical, okay? Because I'll talk specifically about some experimental avenues in the next couple of days, but it's very hard to say anything sort of general about it. So here's our theory schematically. And what you sort of want to do anytime you have, you know, when we had a map of the world that ended at the sort of Pacific coast of Europe, at least, you know, those of us of European ancestry had such a map. We invaded the rest of the world by pushing at its boundaries. Sorry, did I say Pacific?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I obviously meant Atlantic. It's been a long day. Thank you, Michael. So you want to sort of push on all the boundaries of this and just see where it breaks. You can look for new interactions, new particles, new structures. Maybe, you know, we have a two-dimensional table here. Should there really be a three-dimensional table? And really try to test that in every way you can. And I think, okay, we have to be practical. So we know about these problems, just discuss them, and they should certainly inform how we explore. But those problems also shouldn't limit what we explore. Okay? Now that's my opinion. It's a very strongly held opinion. But it's just an opinion, and it's not an opinion that everybody agrees with or has to agree with. That, you know, if we have these well-motivated experiments that address the problem and we have a finite budget, should we spend all our money on that instead of doing these so-called fishing expeditions to just see what's out there? And my answer to that is to just look at the history of the standard model. So I'll spend a few minutes doing that with what I hope are some fun examples of how we can be led astray. But first, I am very hesitantly going to play this game with you guys. Okay, so I'm hesitant because because this is supposed to be a short game that sheds light on government policy, corporate America, and why no one likes to be wrong, which is really not my area of expertise. Also, just because I've never done something like this in a lecture before. And also, apparently, there's some breaking news going on. Okay, so here's how the game works. I had a lot of fun with this myself over the weekend, and I want to see how we do as a group. So they have chosen a rule. Some sequences of three numbers obey this rule, and some do not. And our job as a collaboration is to guess what the rule is. And in the process, we're allowed to do experiments. So our experiments will be to enter a sequence of numbers into these boxes. I will solicit suggestions of sequences from you. And then check whether they obey the rule or not. This is much easier than any kind of modern physics experiment. But okay, so we know that this sequence, 248, obeys the rule. And so that might give you some ideas as to what the rule might be. By the way, if anybody else found this online and played with it already, please don't talk, okay? let's keep this for the new people and the benevolent dictator. All right. We can compare notes afterwards then. So, Itai.
1, 2, 4.
1, 2, 4. Why do you think 1, 2, 4 is a good sequence to try?
To obey the same power laws as this one.
Excellent. Let's check it. Congratulations, Itai. You chose a good sequence. All right. Anybody else brave enough to try a sequence?
3, 5, 7.
3, 5, 7. Why 3, 5, 7?
Because it just increases. It's just each number increases.
Okay. Cool. Congratulations. All right.
Put 7, 5, 3.
7, 5, 3.
Just flip it around. See if his hypothesis was that it increases. Let's see if a decreasing something is going to give it him.
Oh my god! I don't know what to do with you guys. Really? All right. Well. I guess this is why we collaborate, so that we can mock the people who would enter some wrong.
0, 0, 0. Let's see if it has to be increasing.
Okay. 1, 2, 1,000. Then all three increasing sequences should be yes if the public. All
right. So, you really haven't tried this before. All right. Well, you guys are way better at this exercise than I am. So I will tell you what I did. I'll edit it to make myself sound a little bit less stupid. Okay. What you guys did was pretty quickly after getting yes answers. Tried some things that had exactly that you expected to fail. And that is apparently very rare. So in fact, the rule is that each number must be larger than the one before it, and I think you guys were already getting a sense of that because you tried increasing sequences, decreasing sequences, sequences that stayed the same, and really tried to break your hypotheses in every possible way. And that is fantastic. I am very optimistic about the future of our field because you did much better at this than I did. So I'll tell you what I did. I did a bunch of geometric sequences, okay? Actually, I did a bunch of arithmetic sequences, even though this one isn't an arithmetic sequence. That's the really embarrassing part. But, and I convinced myself that, okay, I should check whether it has to be, you know, differing by 2. It could be differing by 3. I should check whether you have to start with an even number. And then I had basically written down my rule in here in this box. But before I clicked I think I know it, that was the point at which I said, wait a minute, I better try some of the alternatives. Okay? And apparently, even that made me better at this puzzle than 78% of people.
Including me.
Okay. But I was still really ashamed of myself because I felt like I had emotionally committed to an answer before really trying to break it. Okay, and that was the point that I wanted to make with this game. And I was even trying to encourage groupthink and like theoretical, really entrench some theoretical speculations, and I just failed.
I think you actually succeeded greatly, right? You have found the collective wisdom.
I think so, yeah.
They have a word for it, right?
Wisdom of the crowd?
Huh?
Wisdom of the crowd?
Wisdom of the crowd, crowdsourcing wisdom.
Yeah, but I thought I could turn the large numbers against you. I really believed that even though every one of you individually is a critical thinker, that I could make you fail. And yeah. So anyway, it's I think it's a problem that we face in physics too, especially now. That for many years we have been we've been confirming a theory in more surprising ways. And it's sort of once you think, oh, well, this should be the case I haven't tried, and it does work, that you get really convinced that you have the right model without ever asking the question, wait, but, you know, but what aspects of the model haven't I challenged yet? So that was the application beyond government and government and corporate America and why no one likes to be wrong that I was going for with this quiz. But anyway. Right. So back to the standard model. So pretty much every word of this framework that I listed is something that we now learn in a very, very textbook linear order, but that came about through surprises. One example, so I mean, most of us know a little bit about the history of quantum mechanics and relativity, and that there were, that, you know, that those were really built on surprising and confusing experimental results. Something you may not know about relativity. Well, one thing you may not know is that Einstein said that actually the Michelson-Morley experiment wasn't that big a part of his thinking at the time he first proposed special relativity. It was the Fizeau experiment, which I'm sure most of us have never heard of. I had to look it up too.
The one with the liquid and the light and the
yeah. If you can explain it better, great. I actually, beyond that, I can't even remember exactly how it works. But also the Michelson-Morley experiment originally, when they didn't find ether frame drag, the explanation was right. That's because we did this experiment in a basement, and somehow all that material above the basement was blocking the ether. So you know, it was sufficiently surprising that you had to change your interpretation of the experiment to support the theory that prevailed at the time. Of course, parity violation, immediately after it was suggested theoretically, there were some experiments that bore it out, but it was this very speculative, you know, unmotivated at the time idea. It could be, and we haven't looked for it yet. Turned out to be the case and very important to how we understand the standard model today. What I'm particularly fond of is non-abelian gauge theories. In fact, there's this paper, I really like this paper, Steve Weinberg's, it's from 1965, about sort of trying to derive, this was during the days when he was trying to understand field theories from a sort of S matrix first principles perspective. And he had some choice words to say of it. So he was trying to understand where things like QED and general relativity might come from. He had some choice words to say about extended gauge invariance. So basically in his introduction, he says, well, I should contrast this with the alternatives. I'm going to contrast this with other authors who have tried to derive electrodynamics or general relativity from other first principles. And so, of course, then he went on and listed a couple of options and trashed those principles. And the first principle he chose was extended gauge invariance. Because he said it was ad hoc, no one would have ever dreamed of it if they didn't already know Maxwell's theory, which is fair. And that in particular, extended gauge invariance has found no application to the strong or weak interactions, though attempts have not been lacking. So, well, if this was anybody other than
Michael. If you don't understand the joke, you have not listened to anything Michael said in the last year.
So, you know, non-abelian gauge theories were, of course, invented by theorists first, but really seemed like too much of a curiosity to have anything to do with nature to many people for a long time. And even when they were, when people tried to apply them to nature, were often found lacking. So that's the framework. Then I went through and asked, what about the particles in the standard model? Did they follow this, you know, did the kind of thinking that I've talked about before, the real problems with, you know, these are the problems with the standard model, these are the things that we need to explain. Did that line of thinking really work to find the standard model? And, you know, standard model's big, so we have a pretty large data set in which to ask that question. So maybe we can disagree about some cases, but I think there were two particles that were really predicted in a canonical way. There was a well-established framework, And you really, based on that framework, expected these particles to be there. So in both cases, there were the partners in a doublet, in a weak doublet, of a particle that had already been found, the tau neutrino and the top quark. So these were sort of the most canonical prediction experiment sequence that you could ever hope for. Even there were surprises, right? Neutrino oscillations were surprising and deeply controversial for decades. And the top mass also was surprisingly large compared to early expectations. Then there are four more that I think fit this sort of solid motivation category that we like to talk about. Those are the muon neutrino, the Higgs, the W, and the Z. So all of these, actually, I just learned about the muon neutrino a couple of days ago. I was very excited. I didn't know about the history of the muon neutrino at all. Sorry, I knew there was a muon neutrino before a couple of days ago. But I didn't know how it was actually experimentally tested. So it turns out, I mean, the Higgs, W, and Z, you know very well, they were solutions to weak scale unitarity problems, right? In the Fermi interactions for the case of the W and the Z, and the Higgs to weak boson scattering. The muon neutrino was a solution to the problem that if muon decay through some unknown interactions, because this was still in the Fermi theory, was actually a decay to two types of neutrino, that any reasonable UV completion of this theory would also have a sizable branching ratio for mu to E gamma at the level of about 10 to the minus 4. Okay, so in particular, it was known to be a sort of charged current interaction. So I think the way it works is that you would have a mu nu and then some boson interaction, an E nu, and then some boson. That boson had to be charged, right? So you could sew this together, connect the boson, and since it's a charged boson, radiate a photon off of it, for example. And there were general arguments that actually any UV completion of this, if the two neutrinos were the same kind of particle, would have a mu to E gamma branching ratio at 10 to the minus 4. Well, I can sew them together, but I'm not gonna radiate a photon off of that. Off the initial or final state. That's true. But yeah. So this motivated people to eventually to actually try to do experiments to tell whether there were different types of neutrinos. One that would, in its charged current interactions, produce electrons, and one that would produce muons. And sure enough, they found that was the case.
I think the Fabius diagrams were actually finite. This would be just an order of magnitude estimate, but it's not a finite loop.
All right, exercise to think about later tonight. Now, by the way, all of these were also non-unique possibilities, but indirect data before the particles were actually, there turned out to be indirect data that was easier to acquire than the direct proof of who it was that turned them into the preferred solutions before they were discovered. So there's a tendency to sort of rewrite history and act like they were inevitable. But if you just ask, you know, at the time, did anybody really know? And remember, this was before the weak doublet structure. So this, you know, same neutrino interacting with the muon and the electron, say through some scalar boson, would have been pretty reasonable. You could have just had one type of neutrino interact with both muons and electrons. Nobody really even knew what a muon was. And a large mu to E gamma branching ratio. And that would have been a perfectly viable theory at the time. But once mu to E gamma was bound by at the 10 to the minus 8 level, it was pretty clear that you needed to go for something else. Likewise, in the case of the Higgs, could have been something like Technicolor, could have been a multi-Higgs doublet model, and still could be a multi-Higgs doublet model on a certain regime. W and the Z. There were alternatives that were just sort of gradually ruled out before discovery came about. But it was not at all clear that these were the unique solutions when they were first proposed. Nonetheless, these are cases that I think fit the canonical framework of a discovery experiment that's directly motivated by theory. But I think they're actually just the exceptions. So if we go to everything else, they were pretty much all experimental surprises that's often borne out in their names. Things like, or famous quotes, you know, Robbie said about the muon, who ordered that. The positron is actually an amusing case because it was predicted before it was observed, but that prediction was largely thought to be a problem with the theory, with an otherwise successful theory, rather than a bona fide prediction. Likewise, the observations that led to the proposal of a neutrino were equally compatible with just statistical violation of energy momentum conservation, and many people thought that was the better alternative than introducing some new invisible particle. The tau is actually a really interesting case. It's recent enough that we can actually read a lot of recollections about its discovery. This is a case where there was some speculative but not very motivated theory out there about so-called sequential leptons, right? This wacky idea that if there was an electron and a muon, an electron neutrino and a muon neutrino, we might as well look for a third generation too. This was actually one of Martin Perls' hobby horses, but largely not something that he felt he could spend much time on or get many resources for. In fact, you see in the proposal for the Mark I experiment that eventually discovered the tau, this is from his sort of retrospective reminiscences on the discovery of the tau, that it was left for last in the proposal, only got 3 pages because it seems to be a remote dream. And actually, of those 3 pages, most of them weren't about the sequential lepton idea. They were about these triplets of leptons, forget exactly what they were called, where you would have, for example, instead of just an electron and a neutrino interacting with one another weakly, you could also have actually a triplet of states with a charged, excited lepton. And there were a couple of different types of heavy lepton that had been developed as sort of wild-eyed speculative types of lepton that we should look for, one of which turned out to be there. And then the hadrons and quarks, again, you know, you wouldn't have called them the strange particle if everyone thought that they were totally normal thing that ought to be there, that was predicted by theory. B quarks were discovered through the upsilon resonance, and that's not my pun, it's Leon Letterman's pun. Charm is another one of these interesting cases where there actually was a group that had really predicted that it should be there, but this was like one of 20 predictions that was out there for what was going on with flavor changing processes among messengers at the time. And the value of quantum field theory, it was the quantum field theorists that were advocating this, and of course it turned out to be a pretty successful framework. So now everybody remembers that charm is inevitable. But at the time, it was really unclear whether quantum field theory was the right perspective be applying to this stuff. And again, there's some nice reminiscences you can find online if you're interested in this stuff by both Bert Richter and Sam Ting about the sort of state of, probably by Shelley as well, about the state of the field and in particular E plus E minus collisions studying hadronic processes before charm was discovered. Also, another bit about the tau. So the tau and the charm, tau and j-psi were discovered right around the same time and have around the same mass. So there was a lot of skepticism about whether there really was a tau or whether Pearl and company were just confused about backgrounds coming from producing pairs of j-psi's. And that persisted for many years. And there were people that ruled out the tau and all the usual stuff. So my conclusion from all of this, and of course you can draw any lesson at all that you want from history, and I already told you that I have an agenda, is pretty aligned, at least in broad brush, with the way that Martin Pearl closed that reminiscence I was quoting from earlier, which is, well, he had a nice one-line quote from Francis Bacon. They are ill discoverers that think there is no land when they can see nothing but the sea. Now, okay, I've looked up the context for this quote, and I don't think that I want to embrace or explain it. but the it's basically saying we should study metaphysics. Okay? But you know, maybe Beyond the Standard Model is kind of metaphysics too. I don't know. It's at least pushing the boundaries of physics. So close it up. Pearl says the Standard Model is the sea of particle physics. And we don't know what it conceals that is new and more fundamental. And so he closes with the tau is new land, the sea of two generations, and perhaps it will lead us out of the sea, the Standard Model. So I'm not willing to bet most of my money on the tau in particular, but there are many aspects of the Standard Model to which this sentiment very much applies. And I think often the challenge is to find the sort of soft spots to push on, to figure out how to test the Standard Model effectively. Fortunately, it's not quite as easy as just saying, why don't I try a downward sequence of numbers and press the check button. If it were, we would advance much faster. And that's really the point I wanted to close on. Because at the same time that we can talk about experimentation and challenging these expectations, we do live in a time when experiments are getting expensive, large, time-consuming. And the theoretical framework that we're working in has been tested to great precision. And so that makes it harder to ask, how should we do meaningful exploration? How do we spend our time on that? So I think, well, you guys are clearly much better at this than I am, as demonstrated by the New York Times challenge. So maybe I shouldn't give you my answers, and I certainly hope you will come up with your own. But I think there are a lot of opportunities to do this in a sort of broad and cost-effective way. So things like precision experiments cast a really wide net. They'll find the stuff that they can find things that we're looking for and things that we're not looking for. Things like exotic searches at the LHC are piggybacking on a very large experimental effort and with a very low marginal cost. And there's new small experiments that you can do to target. There's often fairly small, relatively inexpensive experiments that you can do to target other kinds of things that haven't been thought about much before. And that'll be one of the themes of, I guess, both my lectures and Matt's tomorrow. But for the theorists in the audience, maybe what I'll underscore is that to frame this conversation and to really advance it productively, often it's not enough to just say, I'm gonna do something and see whether I get a non-standard model answer. You want to know that there are consistent and reasonably complete frameworks where you could find something new in this new experiment without being totally inconsistent with everything that's been found so far. And so I think finding theoretical frameworks within which to challenge the Standard Model is actually something that's really important to do as theorists, even if those frameworks are not motivated to solve a specific puzzle, just because they give us a way to identify what experimental directions to pursue and at least shed some light on how to prioritize them. So that's it. I don't think I really need to summarize such simple points, but I'll leave this up for a while and welcome any questions or discussion.